Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with America's vaccination crisis, with measles outbreaks in 15 states, and the number of measles cases in just the first 3 months of this year already totaling the second highest number of cases since 2000, when measles was eradicated. Arthur Kaplan, Professor of Bioethics and Director of the Division of Medical Ethics at New York University's Langone Medical Center's Department of Population Health, joins us to discuss the difficulty of pulling the nation together to combat a growing threat, which is dealt with at the state level when an entrenched minority does not share in the scientific reality of the need for vaccination. Furthermore, the leader of our country attacks science and believes in ridiculous conspiracy theories, among which are the anti-vaxxer delusions that the wife of his just-departed White House communications director, Darla Shine, is a vocal proponent of. We will examine the role of social media in spreading the deadly selfishness of people whose personal belief systems trump public safety as they place at risk patients with compromised immune systems like those suffering from AIDS and those receiving cancer treatment, not to mention newborn babies. With the move by the state of California to end the personal belief loophole, we will look into what can be done to stop the current measles epidemic from spreading. Then we'll get an analysis of the recent elections in Turkey, which were a rebuke to the country's authoritarian leader, Erdogan, who is disputing the results in the main cities where his Islamist party was defeated by the secular CHP, Republican People's Party, but won in the rural areas. David Phillips, the director of the Peace Building and Rights Program at the Institute for the Study of Human Rights at Columbia University and author of The Great Betrayal, How America Abandoned the Kurds and Lost the Middle East, joins us to discuss Trump's reckless amateurism in pulling the U.S. out of Syria and abandoning the Kurds before the captured ISIS fighters and their families are vetted, thus allowing the terrorists to filter back to Europe and America to try to kill us again. Then finally, we'll examine the phenomenon of comedians being elected in Guatemala, Italy, and now Ukraine, where a comedian starring in a popular TV show that portrays a regular guy suddenly becoming the leader of a country run by corrupt politicians, which, if Volodymyr Zelensky wins in the April 21st runoff election, would make truth stranger than fiction. Stephen Pfeiffer, a former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine and senior director for Russia and Ukraine on the National Security Council, joins us to discuss whether this novice non-politician, if elected, is up to handling Vladimir Putin. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now is Arthur Kaplan, who's Professor of Bioethics and Director of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU's Langone Medical Center's Department of Population Health. He writes a regular column on bioethics for NBC.com and is a monthly commentator on bioethics and healthcare issues for WebMD Medscape. Welcome to Background Briefing, Arthur Kaplan.
Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you. You've been writing about this for some time in terms of warning about this America's vaccination crisis. And the issue, of course, is that now we have a measles epidemic breaking out. And how can we defeat that if Americans don't share in a collective reality about what is real and what is true?
Very difficult to take on infectious disease if you've got a president who is not respectful or supportive of science and who in fact has expressed over the years doubts about vaccine safety himself. We have many of our legislators at the local level and at the federal level who also express reservations about vaccine safety and vaccine efficacy, which is a subject that in my view is beyond disputing, studied some more and shows both a good and very reasonable safety profile and strong efficacy. And then we've got social media, which I've been warning about for some time is kind of the accelerant to vaccine resistance, because it circulates all kinds of rumors and half-truths and false statements, and they go on and on and on the internet and on sites like Facebook and Amazon, listing anti-vaccine books prominently. So it's a tough uphill fight.
Well, you know, you mentioned Trump. I mean, he had in his administration this guy from Fox, Bill Shine, who's no longer there because there's obviously a high turnover. But Shine's wife, Darla Shine, she was a prominent anti-vaxxer. And, and what's ironic about the anti-vaxxers is that they're not necessarily uneducated and sort of fringe people. They're actually usually sort of affluent, middle-class, upper-middle-class types. So what explains that?
Well, historically, anti-vaccination views have been rooted in fears of safety of the vaccines. And probably the biggest worry was that vaccines would be giving children autism and that they were accountable for a big increase in autism. But it doesn't make sense, because autism is still with us and still on the increase, and vaccine participation has dropped. It's also the case that we're starting to be able to diagnose autism before the age of vaccination, see it in newborns, even see it prenatally. It seems as if there are genetic factors, infection factors, and ironically, even getting things like the flu during pregnancy seems to cause autism. So you want to get your shot for the flu, even if you're pregnant. But the ground has shifted more recently as people have started to take on that safety debate. And so something else has emerged, and that is what I'll call love of the natural. And that's what Darlene Shine was touting, and many others do who are more in the educated classes. That is, the natural is good. Getting the measles, getting the chicken pox, getting the flu confers, quote unquote, natural resistance. The way to prevent diseases is to eat natural foods and to engage in a sort of lifestyle that boosts your immune system. The only problem with this is that nature often is nasty. A good deal of the time, it's trying to kill you. Bacteria and viruses are out there that are not your friend, and they cause diseases. And if you catch these diseases, some may build immunity, but some will die, and some will become disabled. And you don't really want to use that route to try and resist diseases. So this naturalness movement, exemplified by things like Goop, Gwyneth Paltrow's company, has caught on in pockets of highly educated people. But I think, again, it's not good for the public health, and it doesn't make any scientific sense.
Well, the latest insanity, and I don't know whether you can pin this on Gwyneth Paltrow, but she certainly has some odd ideas, among which is putting some kind of a rock in your vagina. Talk about being between a rock and a hard place. I mean, the whole thing's insane. But now what's becoming popular are packages of raw water, which are unfiltered, untreated, and unsterilized water. That's apparently becoming popular in the Silicon Valley elite. So,
right, and raw water, unfiltered, unchlorinated, unscreened, is certainly a great way to confirm my hypothesis that nature is not always friendly, whether it's getting Giardia if you drink out of natural streams and you pick up infectious agents from beavers and animals like that that poop in the water, or whether you're going to get toxic substances in your raw water that, again, you've not sterilized for. There's a little bit of the only the strong will survive this ridiculous idea. It reminds me a little bit of the raw milk movement, which also has devotees all over the place. But the reason we got pasteurization is that a lot of people before that who were drinking raw milk didn't live to enjoy their next meal.
And again, I'm speaking with Arthur Kaplan, who's professor of bioethics and director of the Division of Medical Ethics at New York University's Langone Medical Center's Department of Population Health. He writes a regular column on bioethics for NBC.com and is a monthly commentator on bioethics and healthcare issues for WebMD Medscape. So one of the things that's extraordinary about this anti-vaccine movement, and we've had people here at this same radio station I'm broadcasting out of who have propagated this for some time, And it's all based upon a very discredited study by a British doctor who I believe, was he a pediatrician? No, he wasn't. He was an orthopedic.
Yes, urologist, a gut was, man.
Yeah, okay. So that his specialty wasn't necessarily related to immunization, but he was completely discredited. I believe he was he not disbarred or whatever?
License was taken away. Andrew Wakefield, isn't it?
Right, right. And he's still out there, and he's still got a cult following. So what,
not only is he still out there, he moved here from England and is running around Texas, and he's in the business of detoxifying people who fear they've been given too much mercury from vaccines. So that old canard, he's now making money out of it.
Really? I mean, that's no different from the 19th century snake oil people, right? He's just...
Yeah.
My God. So why do people stick with a guy like that who's clearly a huckster and not deal with the reality that the Lancet withdrew, repudiated what they'd written, and he himself has had his medical license taken away and has been proven to be a complete fraud and a crank?
Well, I think there's two reasons. One is people who have kids afflicted with autism want an explanation, and we don't fully understand what's going on with autism. Someone who comes along and says, I have the answer, it's simple. It's vaccines. It gives you something to hang on to. So there's an attractiveness, even if the explanation is utterly wrong, and not only utterly wrong, it's so wrong-headed that it kills people because it leads to people dying and becoming disabled from infectious diseases around the world. Remember, not only is there a vaccine issue in the U.S., we've got tens of thousands of people unvaccinated in the Philippines, Madagascar, Ukraine, Italy, lots of problems due to this crank theory going on, but it's sort of an explanation that people are desperate for. The other reason, I think, is that some people believe that vaccines are kind of a plot from big pharma or powerful money-making agents, and, you know, he appeals to that and sort of says, I'm the little guy, they're trying to crush me or silence me. Now, vaccines make money, no doubt about it, but they don't make money the way drugs do or medical devices do. They're not a huge winner for the industry. They make money for sure, but I don't think that's the motivation of the pharmaceutical industry to promote vaccines as a moneymaker. And weirdly enough, there are fewer vaccine manufacturers today than there were 30 years ago. A lot of them got out of the business because they didn't make enough money.
So what is happening now, though, with measles? I mean, if you don't mind explaining, as a medical professional, the logic of herd immunization.
So even a measles vaccination is not 100% effective. Some people don't build resistance to it. So let's say it works in the average person 90% of the time. The virus is highly contagious. Measles jumps around person to person really easily, much more than the flu or even the mumps. And so the best way to protect against it is to get vaccinated. But the more people who are vaccinated in a town or an area of town, the harder it is for the virus to find someone to jump into. So even if you are vaccinated, but if it didn't work so well on you, then you could give it to somebody else. But if they're vaccinated, then the odds of them being better protected are good. So overall, if you can get 92-95% of a community vaccinated, even if it didn't work on everybody, it's very hard for the virus to find someone to jump into. Does that make sense?
It does make sense, but of course it doesn't make sense to people who to this day still are anti-vaxxers and may well not be persuadable, but there was this
The other thing to say about herd immunity and trying to vaccinate the community, there are people out there who can't vaccinate because of health reasons.
Sure.
So if you got a transplant or you had cancer treatment or you're undergoing HIV treatment, your immune system is weak and it is turned off. And if your neighbor doesn't vaccinate, if your neighbor doesn't vaccinate their kids, then they're a threat to you. So vaccination, well, sometimes put in a personal choice way, you know, I have the right to do with my body what I want or with my kids what I want, is actually, if you don't do it, you are a lousy, not responsible neighbor.
Well, but it's worse, isn't it? You are also endangering newborns because...
That's another group that can't vaccinate. You have to wait a little while till their immune systems turn on. And so they, too, are highly vulnerable. And we've seen deaths, for example, from flu, this past season in the neonatal nurseries in the U.S. that could have been prevented if the people who came to visit those babies had been vaccinated.
So what came out of the appearance before the Congress of the young man whose mother was an anti-vaxxer and he had to sue her to get vaccinated?
Well, it's not as if there are oodles of kids out there waiting to override their parents and say, I want to be vaccinated. But there are some. And that young man was very useful because he basically said, I think my parents are nuts. I've read the literature. Vaccination makes sense. I have a right to be vaccinated, and I'm going to try and get it done, even though I'm a minor child. I think he was 16 or 17. But I want it to happen to me, and I think he found a willing doctor to do it. It's a reminder that if you put sound and sensible information out there, even kids in middle school and high school can get a message that maybe their parents are unable to absorb. You want to be vaccinated. It's the best thing you can do in the face of flu, cervical cancer, measles, mumps, rubella, all the rest of them.
Right, but the state of California closed the personal choice, religious choice loophole that allowed parents to exempt their children from vaccination. What's happening at the federal level? That young man did testify before the Congress. Has anything developed?
Well, remember, vaccine policy, like many things, is state-based. So the federal government can't impose limits on vaccine exemptions. Those have to happen state by state. California, I think, did the right thing in saying no more religious exemptions, no more personal exemptions. That is to say, just conscience objections. The only way you can avoid vaccination for your kid going to school is if there's a health reason. Washington State is emulating that. We have a bill here in New York that we're trying to push through to do the same. Other states do too. And you can see that the states that have the toughest restrictions have the fewest cases of measles.
So what's happening apart from California? How much is this spreading? We know that measles is spreading, so I'm trying to figure out what the countervailing forces are across the country.
Well, a bit of good news. Facebook and some other social media sites are starting to say, we're going to pull down some of this misinformation. It's a little bit like Holocaust denial stuff. We're not going to really let it just go and let anybody say anything untrue or false about vaccination. There's still free speech to say, I don't want to do it, but you can't lie about vaccine safety. That's a plus. Some states are following California to try and limit exemptions. I think that's a plus. The harsh reality is when you have huge measles outbreaks in New York City and around New York, in Washington State, in Michigan, in many other states, people notice and they get the attention of folks. We've had a big uptick in measles vaccinations here in New York because we're having this gigantic 300 case plus outbreak. So sadly, when you decide to believe non-vaccination bunk, you don't vaccinate, we get outbreaks, people go to the hospital, people risk disability for their kids from measles, deafness, and they then decide maybe the vaccination story was one worth listening to.
Well, I hope people are listening to you and to your fellow medical professionals, because it is insane and it is dangerous. And as I say, it's even happening here at this very radio station in terms of people have been propagating this dangerous anti-vaccine nonsense. I thank you for joining us, Arthur Kaplan.
Hey, my pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Arthur Kaplan, who's Professor of Bioethics and Director of the Division of Medical Ethics at New York University's Langone Medical Center's Department of Population Health. He writes a regular column on bioethics for NBC.com and is a monthly commentator on bioethics and healthcare issues for WebMD Medscape. We're going to take a brief station break and back with an analysis of the elections in Turkey that were rebuked to the country's authoritarian leader, Erdogan.
soon. When will my ship come in?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now, David Phillips, who's the director of the Peace Building and Rights Program at the Institute for the Study of Human Rights at Columbia University. He's a former senior advisor and foreign affairs expert to the United States Department of State during the administrations of Presidents Clinton, Bush, and Obama. And he's the author of An Uncertain Ally, Turkey Under Erdogan's Dictatorship, and The Great Betrayal, How America Abandoned the Kurds and Lost the Middle East. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Phillips.
Thank you so much, Ian.
And Turkey's president, Erdogan, and his AKP party have basically really been handed a rebuke. Obviously, there's a divide in the country of Turkey between the rural conservative Islamists and the urban city secularists. But the secular party, the CHP, the Republican People's Party, won in all the major cities, albeit narrowly, Ankara, Izmir, and Istanbul. And now Erdogan is contesting those results, and he's running around putting up AKP posters all around the cities. So is he going to get away with this?
So the people will be outraged if the outcome in Istanbul is reversed. One thing the AKP has become very adept at is stealing elections. They've been involved in electoral fraud repeatedly over the years, so they know well how to manipulate the results. I'm sure the results in Turkey's major cities were subject to the same manipulation this time as in the past. It shows how popular opinion is so opposed to Erdogan and the AKP party, because they were able to win most major cities despite Erdogan's electoral manipulation.
Well, overall, nationwide, the AKP alliance led won by 51.6%. But in the major cities, in Istanbul, the secular CHP party won 48.8 to 48.5. That's pretty narrow. In Ankara, they won 50.9% compared to 47%. That would be harder to overturn. And in Izmir, they won 58% to 38.6% for AKP. And again, that would be really hard to overturn. But with a narrow margin in Istanbul, I imagine Erdogan's going to go to work on that.
He'll certainly try to reverse the results. It's important, though, to do some analysis about why voters turned on Erdogan and the AKP. On the surface, it looks like a repudiation of his stewardship of the economy. Turkey's economy is in recession. The lira lost 28% of its value in 2018, and then another 5% against the dollar during the weeks leading up to local elections. Purchasing power of consumers has dropped dramatically, and businesses with debts that are denominated in foreign currencies are especially hard hit. And the economic indicators go from bad to worse. The official unemployment is 13%. With youth, it's probably closer to 30%. In addition to that, we've seen high inflation. And Turkish voters are concerned about the overall direction of the country. It's not just the economy, stupid, as James Carville said. They're concerned about Turkey's adventurism in the region, in Syria, its ties to Russia, its support for Maduro in Venezuela, close cooperation with Putin and with China. There's a long list of concerns that Turkish voters have, starting with the economy, but also including Erdogan's conduct in regional and international relations.
So on the U.S. side, of course, the U.S. has blocked Turkey from receiving equipment associated with the F-35 fighter jet, which the Turks have ordered. Apparently, the first two planes have been delivered, but they're down in Arizona's at Luke Air Force Base, where Turkish pilots are training with them. The U.S. is upset with Erdogan for buying Russian S-400 Triumph ground-to-air missiles, which are apparently the most advanced air defense system in the world. And now we just heard that the Secretary of Defense, former Boeing executive, Shanahan, is now saying that Turkey will probably get the F-35. What kind of leverage does the U.S. have there? I mean, Trump has this peculiar affection for despots. Where does this relationship stand with Erdogan? He got mad at him at one point, I recall. I think it was over what he felt was lying to him about the American preacher that belonged to the same evangelical cult that Vice President Pence belongs to.
So let's be clear about the S-400s. They're a sophisticated surface-to-air missile technology, but they're not as sophisticated as the Patriot missile system. In a bid to get Erdogan to back off his $2.5 billion purchase from Russia, the U.S. offered Turkey Patriots at a lower price. They were rebuffed by Erdogan. In response to that, the Pentagon canceled Turkey's participation in the F-35 stealth fighter program. The S-400s come with Russian military attachés, and they don't want them on the ground in proximity to the F-35s. If Russia got its hands on the stealth technology, it would neutralize a major asset of the fighter jet. So those two areas of security cooperation now are of utmost concern. But there are things that the United States can do beyond canceling the F-35 to show its displeasure with Turkey. In Şırnak Air Force Base in Antalya is the historic and strategic hub of U.S. operations in Turkey. It's been the point of departure for U.S. operations in Iraq and Afghanistan. Every 6 months, we have to renegotiate the memorandum of understanding with Turkey to use in Şırnak. And they always reserve a 72-hour window to kick us out if they don't like what we're doing. It's time for the U.S. to find alternative base leasing arrangements. There are opportunities in Cyprus, in Jordan, in Romania. We should just close in Şırnak and move on. There's also the IMET, the International Military and Training Program, which we've operated with the Turkish military for decades. Now all those officers have been Islamicized, so we should simply cancel IMET. There's a lot that the U.S. can do to signal its displeasure, not the least of which is Turkey's confrontational approach in the region, and especially Syria. Now, Turkey has threatened to attack the U.S. allies in Syria, the People's Protection Units, who are Syrian Kurds, and part of the SDF, the Syrian Democratic Forces. If they do that and there's collateral damage of U.S. forces, that completely changes the nature of U.S.-Turkey relations. Turkey threatened to go after the SDF without concern for U.S. special forces on the ground. This is just absolutely intolerable. Erdogan's hubris has now reached a level that can't be accepted by the United States, and it seems that Turkish voters are turning against it as well. They don't want the U.S. and Turkey to have a major falling out, which is underway. And which should occur if Turkey stays on its current course. They're also concerned about Turkey's relations with the European Union. The European Parliament's voted to suspend accession talks. So Turkey is now increasingly isolated from the West. Erdogan is a steward of an economy in collapse. His regional and international adventurism isn't appreciated by Turkish voters. So Erdogan needs a wake-up call. And if the voters don't give it to him, U.S. policymakers should.
Well, but he's practicing what Samuel Johnson referred to as religion being the last refuge of the scoundrel. So that's a hard nut to crack if he's got all this support amongst the Islamists. And by purging the military, as he did since the failed coup, little wonder that the only officers left are Islamists. Let's talk a little bit about this election campaign, the results of which Erdogan is contesting in the major cities. He won the countryside but lost the cities, and it's the first time that he's been handed a rebuke by the people. And as you've said, David, the tide is turning against him. But the campaign that he ran was the most despicable and disgusting campaign any politician's ever ran. He used the video, the helmet camera video of that Australian assassin who murdered all of those people in the mosques who were praying in New Zealand. And I've not seen the footage, and I have no interest in seeing the footage, but people who have seen the footage said it's the most gruesome footage you could ever imagine. And yet he played that. Erdogan played that footage at rallies to whip up this anti-Western, pro-Islamist sentiment. And then he even, you know, referred to the Gallipoli in 1915 about how the New Zealanders were sent home in coffins, and he'd do the same thing as though somehow these peace-loving people in New Zealand were about to invade Turkey. It was a despicable. And then the SOB turns around and writes a nice op-ed in the Washington Post saying how much he respects New Zealand's Prime Minister and how well she handled the whole thing. In other words, here's this guy shamelessly pandering to his domestic audience at the same time shamelessly pandering to the international audience. The guy is just a catastrophe.
So what he did was despicable. In New Zealand, it's a crime to rebroadcast footage of the assassination, the killing at the Al Noor Mosque. If it's a crime in New Zealand, they should issue an Interpol red bulletin for Erdogan and try to restrict his international travel, fueling the sectarian tensions and trying to divide society by stoking his Islamist base only weakens Turkey and polarizes the country. Like the United States, Turkey is about evenly divided between the Anatolian heartland and then the more cosmopolitan, progressive major cities. What we saw with these local elections was a major setback to Erdogan. It's the first time in the 15 years that he's been involved in national electoral politics that Turkish voters have handed him a major defeat. It dents his armor and it sends a signal that the AKP is not invincible. Unfortunately, Turks are stuck with Erdogan as president for another 4.5 years unless some extraordinary event occurs and he's removed from office.
Well, since you know the Kurds well, David, let's turn a little bit to, you mentioned earlier about his threat to attack the Syrian Democratic Forces, which are largely Kurds. Now, just to go back to the point at which the Secretary of Defense, General Mattis, and the point man on Syria, Brett McGurk, quit in protest to Trump pulling out the small number of U.S. troops from Syria that were small footprint, but they had a lot of strategic influence in the neighborhood. And largely, they've been protecting the Kurds. One of the things that McGurk's trying to make public, and I don't know why more people aren't paying attention to him, because it indicates just how reckless and dangerous this idiot president we have, this unbelievably ill-informed, reckless character, Trump. Trump was about to pull all of those U.S. forces out, and their main job is to protect the Kurds, who are in turn processing all of these Islamic State fighters and their families that are coming out of the ruins of the last little redoubt, and now they've been all rolled up. So you've got these big prison camps where all of these people, many of whom are just dedicated killers who want to get to the West and start killing people, they have to be processed. And the only people who are doing it are the Kurds, and they're not getting support from the United States. And that's what McGurk quit in protest. He couldn't believe how stupid it is for the Trump administration to withhold American support and funds at the very moment of the victory that Trump's running around proclaiming, I defeated the Islamic State. Well, if you don't secure the victory and these people are able to get out of these camps and wreak mayhem in Western Europe and in the United States, what kind of a victory is that?
So I was in northern Syria in the Kurdish region called Rojava in mid-December. 2 days before Trump and Erdogan had their phone conversation on December 19. Apparently, Trump was given talking points by his staff, warning Erdogan not to come in, that the U.S. was going to establish the security buffer. And during the conversation, Erdogan assured him, "We'll do that for you. Why do you put your troops in harm's way?" And Trump's response was, "You're right. Northern Syria is yours. You can have it." It's completely incoherent policymaking. It didn't go through a vetting process, and it doesn't seem to have been an enduring pronouncement. Jim Mattis resigned. Brett McGurk resigned as well. Then, instead of reducing the troop levels from 5,000 special forces to 200, which was the initial indication from the White House, we saw a report in the Wall Street Journal that the number would be reduced to 1,000. Then Shanahan's office, the current Secretary of Defense, repudiated that report, said, "No, we are going down to 200. So there's a completely incoherent, confused, and chaotic policymaking process. I also want to make a point about defeating the Islamic State. We've seen the Trump administration shift its rhetoric. Now they're talking about defeating the caliphate. And it's true, the caliphate as an institution has been defeated by the Kurds with air support and special forces support coming from the United States. But that doesn't mean that the Islamic State as a movement has been defeated. At one point, the Islamic State occupied territory the size of Great Britain. With its defeat in Baghouz last week, they don't control any territory. But that doesn't mean that the Islamic State is defeated and is gone. Those fighters have disappeared. They'll become diffuse and then reappear at some later point. If these prison camps that the Kurds are holding have to close down and those foreign fighters are released, they're going to go back to their countries and wage jihad there. The idea that we've defeated the Islamic State is a schoolboy's fool's errand. Trump doesn't know what he's dealing with. He doesn't understand how deeply rooted in Sunni society the Islamic State has become. And the fact that it's now a worldwide movement with affiliates in 48 different countries. So we shouldn't be too quick to rush to judgment and claim victory. This is going to be a generational endeavor. It requires hard power to kill Islamic State fighters, but it also requires an enduring commitment of soft power, education, economic development, democratic development, and women's rights in order to drain the swamp of support for the Islamic State. We're far from declaring victory.
Yeah, but not vetting these people and taking the resources away to vet these people in these prison camps and then letting them go because the resources don't exist and the Kurds are totally strained and they're under attack from Turkey, that's the insane part of it.
It makes no sense at all. You know, these are battle-hardened fighters. Apparently 11,000 Kurds died fighting ISIS. We have them now in camps. They need to be vetted. They need to be carefully managed. Just pulling the plug and saying we're not going to provide any additional support and forcing the Kurds to essentially let them go is a dishonor to all of the Americans who have died fighting Salafist extremism in Iraq and Syria. And it makes no practical or policy sense to pull the plug on these camps and zero out their funding so that those that are in the camps can be returned to the communities from whence they came. If we want to lose a war, that's how to go about it.
Well, David Phillips, I thank you for joining us here today.
Always good to speak with you, Ian.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with David Phillips, who's the director of the Peace Building and Human Rights Program at the Institute for the Study of Human Rights at Columbia University. He's a former senior advisor and foreign affairs expert to the United States Department of State during the administrations of Presidents Clinton, Bush, and Obama, and he's the author of An Uncertain Ally, Turkey Under Erdogan's Dictatorship, and The Great Betrayal, How America Abandoned the Kurds and Lost the Middle East. We're going to take a brief station break and back examining the phenomenon of comedians being elected in Guatemala, Italy, and now Ukraine. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Stephen Pfeiffer, who is the William J. Perry Fellow at Stanford's Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies, where he's affiliated with their Center for International Security and Cooperation and Europe Center. He served as Deputy Assistant Secretary for State in the Bureau of European and Eurasian Affairs and as U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine and a Special Assistant to the President and Senior Director for Russia, Ukraine, and Eurasia on the National Security Council. And in addition to Kiev, he was also posted in London, Moscow, Geneva, and Warsaw, as well as on the National Security Council. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stephen Pfeiffer.
Thank you for having me.
So something is going on in the world. It's a little odd, geopolitics, and that is that now we have a comedian who's the front runner emerging from the elections that just took place in Ukraine. Or you already have a comedian in charge of Guatemala, and you already have a comedian in the governing coalition in Italy. So are the comedians taking over the world?
Well, let me just make a couple comments on the election that took place on Sunday in Ukraine. I mean, first of all, while international and domestic observers reported some small problems, overall they said the elections were free and competitive. And they certainly were competitive. There were almost 40 candidates running. So Ukrainians had a big choice, or a wide choice. And, you know, this is now going back to 2014, 2010, and in the 2004 election after the Orange Revolution. This is now, you know, four times that Ukraine has run a good election process. So that's good news in a part of the world where free, fair, and competitive elections are not always that common. The result, I think, is if you look at the incumbent, President Poroshenko, and he will be in the runoff against Mr. Zelensky that takes place on April 21. Mr. Poroshenko, I think, has some significant achievements over his first term, but there seems to be in Ukraine some public disaffection that there has not been sufficient progress on the issues of economic reform and on dealing with corruption, including at the level of the oligarchs. And that seems to have led a lot of the voters, particularly young voters, to turn to Mr. Zelensky as a fresh face.
So has this TV series, this hit series that he's a star in, The Servant of the People, has it influenced the vote? I mean, you know, I mean, we are talking in a country where we have a reality TV showman as our president. So it does seem that the imagery is a big part of politics nowadays.
Well, no. In the story, in the TV series, "Servant of the People," you know, he portrays an everyman, a school teacher, who almost by accident gets elected president of Ukraine, and then applies sort of the common person's common sense solutions to some of the problems. And it appears that he did try to play on that image in his campaign. So, for example, on Saturday, before the day before the election, the television station was running his show. And I think that is, to the extent, I mean, he didn't campaign as much as other candidates, but he tried to portray himself as, you know, somebody new who will bring a common sense approach to the problems that Ukraine faces. We will see, you know, whether someone who also lacks really any real political expertise, we'll see on April 21, whether that is enough for the Ukrainian electorate when they have to choose between Mr. Zelensky and Mr. Poroshenko.
Will they have the benefit of TV debates?
That's still an open question. There was a proposal for TV debates prior to the April 21 vote, and neither Mr. Zelensky nor Mr. Poroshenko was prepared to debate then. I think there have been some suggestions that there might be a debate between now and April 21, and I would actually hope that would happen, because it would be an opportunity to really define where Mr. Zelensky is. I mean, he is a new player to politics, and while he's given indication of his general views, he hasn't yet been drawn out on some specific ideas. And I think that would be useful for Ukrainian voters over the course of the next 15, 18 days, so they can make their final decision on April 21.
And again, I'm speaking with Stephen Pfeiffer, who is the William J. Perry Fellow at Stanford's Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies, where he's affiliated with their Center for International Security and Cooperation and Europe Center. He served as a Deputy Assistant Secretary of State in the Bureau of European and Eurasian Affairs and U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine and a Special Assistant to the President and Senior Director for Russia, Ukraine, and Eurasia on the National Security Council. And in addition to Kiev, he had postings in London, Moscow, Geneva, and Warsaw, as well as on the National Security Council. So, what's the, if this guy doesn't have any politics, let's talk about this in the frame of Russia, because Ukraine is still under attack and the low intensity warfare could erupt at any moment. Already the eastern part of the country, which is essentially pro-Russian, is such that they've been able to, with this new bridge that Putin has brought across to Crimea, they've essentially been able to bottle up the Sea of Azov, and now essentially the Ukrainians can't export through that one port that they have at Mariupol. So the squeeze is on still, and the threat of invasion is always there. And how would this guy handle it? He's not apparently a particularly serious person, and this is a serious situation, isn't it not?
No, I mean, if on April 21 he gets elected president, he's going to have to get serious very, very quickly. And he'll face, I mean, there really are today two major challenges facing the president of Ukraine. You know, one is a domestic challenge. How do you complete the economic reforms, build on things that were done in 2015 and 2016 to build a competitive and open economy and to really take a huge chunk out of corruption, really push back against corruption, which continues to hold Ukraine back? That's one problem. The other problem is, how do you deal with the threat posed by Russia? Russia's continuing conduct of a simmering conflict in the eastern Ukrainian area of the Donbas, how do you find a solution to that? And that's one of the things where it would, I think, be useful to Ukrainian voters if over the course of the next 18 days, either in debates or in or the press begins to push Mr. Zelensky to get a better idea of what ideas he has to address these problems, because they're very serious issues. And if he is elected, he's going to have to face them very, very quickly.
So Putin obviously doesn't want to push things too far, I don't think, in terms of Ukraine and any movements towards the West, because I think that it would eventually turn to guerrilla warfare and he would get bogged down. So, but at the same time, this low-intensity warfare that is essentially cheap for him and the economic strangling of Ukraine is very effective. So that is obviously a lot on your plate if you're running this country. But the other part of it is, and the reason for this comedian's appeal is that his character is incorruptible. And isn't corruption still the main issue? And has Poroshenko, the so-called chocolate magnate, has he really dealt with it effectively?
First, a couple comments. I mean, first about Russia and pushing Ukraine. I mean, we have to acknowledge Russia has already done a lot because of Mr. Putin's policy and the Kremlin's policy to push Ukraine towards the West. You now have opinion polls in Ukraine regularly showing pluralities, if not majorities, saying that Ukraine should join the European Union and even that Ukraine should join NATO. And then just a month ago, you had the Ukrainian parliament vote by an overwhelming margin to enshrine in Ukraine's constitution the strategic goals of joining the European Union and NATO. Mr. Putin's policies of the last 5 years have pushed Ukraine away. Now, on the question of corruption, there have been some steps towards corruption, to fighting corruption. So, for example, officials have to make an electronic declaration of their income and of their wealth. And that was a big positive step for transparency. However, there's just been a decision by the Constitutional Court that if your income declared is inconsistent with your actual means, you can't automatically be charged on this. And I think one of the things that held Mr. Poroshenko back in the election is there is this perception among Ukrainians that there has not been enough effort put to the fight against corruption, that Ukrainian courts still remained corrupt, that institutions, including law enforcement institutions, still remain compromised and corrupt. And this was the desire to end corruption was a big thing that brought hundreds of thousands of Ukrainians out into the streets during the Maidan Revolution in 2013 and 2014. And I believe their sense that not enough progress has been made in fighting that corruption is one of the big reasons why Mr. Zelensky came out in the polls so far ahead of Mr. Poroshenko.
Well, what I was suggesting with vis-a-vis Putin is that my sense is that he doesn't want to have a full-scale war, because I think there'd certainly be body bags coming home. It would be a hard sell with the Russian people, even though Putin is supposedly popular. And secondly, it would probably bog Russia down in a guerrilla war. So he's sort of destabilizing it on the cheap. At least that's my analysis of what's going on. What's your opinion on that?
I think you're right. I mean, there have been concerns, including 2 months ago, that there might be a broader Russian offensive against Ukraine in the works. I tended to be dubious about that because, one, a major Russian offensive against Ukraine would bring down more serious sanctions from the West. But as you said, it would also involve Russian troops and Russian casualties. And the Kremlin doesn't want that. You know, what they are doing, though, is sustaining this low-intensity conflict. Their goal is to try to pull Ukraine back into Moscow's orbit. But I believe almost everything the Kremlin has done in the last 5 years has had the opposite impact, in that of pushing Ukraine and pushing Ukrainians away. And their backup goal seems to be that if they cannot have Ukraine back in Moscow's orbit, is they basically want to break the country and make it, as unattractive as possible to Europe, and making it as dysfunctional as they can.
So is that working in the sense that, do the Russians still have their networks, spy networks, their infiltration of Ukrainian intelligence, the infiltration of Ukrainian military? Every now and then, the Russians seem to be able to blow up arms depots in Ukraine using drones and other, again, low-intensity methods, but very effective ones.
Yeah, no, I mean, on the outside, it's hard to know for sure, but my guess is that the Russians have devoted a lot of attention to Ukraine, not just in the last 5 years, but ever since the breakup of the Soviet Union back in 1991, and that there undoubtedly are Russian agents operating within Ukraine. And you see in some cases, in the security service of Ukraine, there are people who have contacts to Moscow, and this is not a secret. I think the Russians are looking at ways to use those agents of influence, again, basically to distract, destabilize Ukraine in a way that makes it harder for Ukraine both to address its domestic agenda of reforms, but also makes it harder for Ukraine to pursue its goal of drawing closer to Europe.
But isn't it a bit of an irony that as much as the Ukrainian people are turning against Russia, and that ultimately will be Putin's legacy, I think, because there was obviously strong fraternal bonds throughout the Soviet period and in the subsequent decades between the two countries, and now the great deal of animus. But to Ukraine's west, you have Hungary that has a pro-Putin government. And I don't know about the Hungarian people, where they stand, but tell me about how that's working.
Well, no, I think this is one of the problems that you've seen in Central Europe, and Hungary is the epitome of that, is you've seen the rise of a leader who has authoritarian preferences and who therefore kind of sees in Putin something of a model. You know, he doesn't, Mr. Orban doesn't, want to have an open democratic system. He wants to tighten authority in a way that I would argue is inconsistent with European values and European norms. But by the same token, though, there have been some positive steps. So, for example, in the Czech Republic, in Slovakia, there was an election where you have somebody elected, a young political leader who very much, supports an open democratic political system. So there's both good news and bad news in Central Europe.
Well, is it, in terms of U.S. Policy, though, as having been the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, we have a peculiar president who's not clear about where his loyalties lie, particularly vis-a-vis Putin, what kind of a relationship they have. So I can't imagine, I know NATO leaders have been puzzled by Trump, and he's never really supported Article 5 of the, mutual defense of the NATO treaty. I don't know what these leaders in Western Europe think. I imagine they're quite nervous, but how about the Ukrainian leaders? What do they think about the U.S. resolve? I mean, John McCain, of course, was a big proponent of arming Ukraine and supporting the Ukrainian government against Russia. But where does Trump stand, and how do the Ukrainians see the situation?
Well, I think Ukrainians probably find themselves in a situation that is somewhat akin to the situation in which NATO European leaders find themselves in. Is on the one hand, in Ukraine, they see an American policy that is supportive of Ukraine, that continues to provide economic assistance, continues to provide military assistance, including lethal military assistance, which was something that the Obama administration was not prepared to do. So very supportive of Ukraine in the same way that NATO leaders see an American policy that is supportive of NATO. And for example, it continues to enhance the American military presence in Central Europe, which the alliance agreed to do after 2014 and Russia's seizure of Crimea and invasion into eastern Ukraine. But in Ukraine and in NATO, they both say, okay, we see this good policy, but they're probably a little bit uncertain because it's never been clear that the president himself supports that policy. So it's one reason when it makes sense, I get up in the morning, I take a look at the president's tweets to see if we're going off in a new direction. But so far, the policy towards Ukraine of the first 2 years of the Trump administration largely seems to be a continuation of where the Obama administration was going in its last 2 years, which was a toughening attitude towards Russia and a policy of offering more support to Ukraine. But again, there's a question mark, which is it's not been clear that the president supports that policy instinctively in the same way that it's not clear that the president supports NATO in the way that we would like.
Well, Stephen Pfeiffer, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Stephen Pfeiffer, who's a William J. Perry Fellow at Stanford Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies, where he's affiliated with their Center for International Security and Cooperation and Europe Center. He served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State in the Bureau of European and Eurasian Affairs, U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine, and Special Assistant to the President and Senior Director for Russia, Ukraine, and Eurasia on the National Security Council. And in addition to Kiev, he had postings in London, Moscow, Geneva, and Warsaw, as well as on the National Security Council. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates, as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now.